NYPD Detective Vic Ferrari, and welcome to NYPD Through the Looking Glass, where you'll get unique insight into the New York City Police Department. Before we get started, please check out my Amazon author page, where you'll find my series of behind-the-scenes NYPD books. My books make great $10 Christmas gifts or $2.99 ebook downloads, including the NYPD's Flying Circus, Cops, Crime, and Chaos. There you can also pre-order my new book, which is out this weekend, NYPD Laughing in the Line of Duty. On today's episode, we're joined by not one, but two medical doctors with over 60 years of practicing medical experience who just happen to be married. Tim and May Hindmarsh are the hosts of the popular BS-Free MD podcast, and I'd like to welcome to the show. Hello, May and Tim. How are you guys doing today?
Very well, thank you. Yes.
Hanging in there, yes.
Yes,
hanging in there.
Hey, I can't complain because we're living in the world of sunny land, continuous endless summer, so I'm happy.
So before we get started with the medical questions and funny stories, please, why don't you guys tell me about yourselves?
How much time do we have? No, I'm kidding. Okay, here's the Sparks Notes condensed version. Tim and I are both born and raised. We're both born and raised in Canada. Became American immigrants in 94 after we graduated residency. We met in med school, got married. We graduated and got married 5 days, 4 days later. Trained, did our residency in Edmonton, Alberta, and family practice, and moved to the U.S. in 94. We lived in Oregon in our one and only dream home, raised our kids there and had a full small town, rural family practices. Tim, I worked part-time and raised kids and was the CEO of the house. And Tim did a full OB practice as well as family practice. We both did, you know, the olden days when doctors would see people in the office and the hospital and the ICU, and we were coroners. So we saw some cool stuff, did house calls. And we've done some third world mission trips. Sometimes I call where we live the third world of America because of some of the things going on. We're empty nesters. Kids left the house and we fled Oregon for sunnier East Coast tropical weather. And we've both been doing urgent care since 2010. And Tim is still doing urgent care now, and I'm semi medically retired, and we're doing a podcast now for the past 3 years since COVID started, which we can get into and talk about that, which is keeping me busy
or not.
And we like to do crazy sports in our spare time and laugh at each other. And that's us. What do you want to say, hon?
No, that's it. I mean, you know, the whole genesis of BS Free MD really started because I had done tons of leadership in corporate medicine, was on the parent board of directors of about $1 billion a year integrated healthcare network in largely rural Oregon. There's about 270 doctors in it. And so I sat on all these committees and I was just like, why do we have to do this? Well, we have to do this because the government tells us to do this. Why do we have to prescribe these things? Well, because it's the law. And I just saw more and more bullshit just like coming out of the system, you know, and then, you know, fast forward through almost 30 years of my career. And I'd bitch about this to May all the time. So we always talk about the fact that the podcast is really just what we normally would do. We just record it because, you know, I'd pull up the study and I'd be like, why are we doing this? There's no evidence for this. This is all nonsense. And then COVID hit and it kind of pulled the scab off of, wow, there's way more nonsense than I thought. Like, it's really crazy. So, you know, it has just been unbelievably rewarding to go down like rabbit hole after rabbit hole and talk to some of the, you know, world experts on different, you know, diets and exercise and evidence-based medicine and pharma and people that were in pharma that, you know, like that have, you know, pulled that mask back and, you know, how studies are faked and just on and on and on. So it's been really, really fun. And that's how we met you. You know, we interviewed you a while ago and people love that episode.
I know. All the time.
It's like you were riding in the police car with you in New York.
It was. I went, whew. And back to Tim's thing, point of talking about our podcast. Basically, as he was saying, that we would talk about this stuff all the time. And sometimes it would be too much medical talk at home and venting. And I'd be like, you know, maybe we should talk to tell somebody else about this. I'm shutting off from work mode. Or the kids would say that, can you guys talk about something else other than medical stuff? Cause we love to gross them out at the dinner table too, which we can get into in a little bit. But we, when COVID hit, and because our friends also would come over and ask us medical questions now and then, you know, over cocktails and things, they'd be like, you guys are hilarious. We love the way you bounce things off one another. And you should do this and so that people can see it. And with COVID and all the questions, obviously everybody had, we started doing Facebook live streams from our library in our house and just opened it up. And we would present some information and kind of organize it a little bit. We would interact with everybody, answer questions as best we could. And we had a bunch of patients and friends, and it was a hit. And from there, we're like, oh, this is going okay. Maybe we should pursue, because we had thought and talked about doing a podcast. And our financial advisor kind of jokingly said, you know, man, you guys have already done the hard part of doing it live, usually with a podcast. You know, if you record it, you could edit and scrub and take out all the stuff you mess up. He said, so if you're doing it live already, doing a podcast should be no problem. And so the nidus from that was we actually ended up in a group called in 2021 called Dr. Podcast Network that was founded by our financial advisor in a group. It's now sort of fizzled, and it's just a support group that we all help each other out.
In your show, I went on that service called PodMatch, which basically
pairs
guests and podcasts together.
Yep.
And I said, well, how am I going to get on this show? It's a medical show. So I think I teased you guys with this, a chapter in one of my books called Sickness, Health, and Fat Bastards, which is about overweight cops and cops trying to get out on disability pensions when there's nothing wrong with them. It's like the health service division, the NYPD, where, you know, 40,000 cops, a lot of them are going to be playing games to try to get out more sick time or try to get out on a disability pension. Although there are plenty of people that are really seriously injured that should get pensions. And it's like sometimes you walk into that office and it looks like an episode of Better Call Saul, where people are wearing the foamed collars and the canes. And it's like, oh, you know, someone should get an Oscar in here. You know, I mean, obviously there are some people that are really sick and hurt, but you're always going to get the scam artists. And I saw quite a bit of that. And what's funny is you guys are about the same age as me. And when May brought up house calls, oh God, I remember as a child, the doctor showing up to our house with his black bag. And I remember we had this doctor when I was a child, and he had, I guess it's alopecia, where you have no hair, no eyebrows, which is scary for a small child. And every friggin' time we went to this guy, it just seemed like I got a shot. And I was little. And he came to the house one day. It was a rainy night. I had the flu or something. And he came over, and now comes that needle. And I go, oh, shit. So I start running around the house, right? My mother pins me. Down comes my pants. And I get a shot. And I'm pissed. I'm probably about five. And I'm just so upset. And I'm crying and screaming and carrying on. And my mother's trying to calm me down. And back then, doctors took cash. And I'll never forget this. This is a true story. My mother is paying the doctor. I come running by and pull the money out of his hand and start running around the house. Now, my mother's mortified. Now, she's chasing me around the house. So then, in addition to a shot, I think I caught a beating for that. But, yeah, that I remember that house call story. It was the first house we lived in. And the guy, like I said, he was bald and he had no eyebrows. So it was like getting chased by Uncle Leo in Seinfeld when Elaine paints the eyebrows on him. And the doctor goes, Leo, I don't like your demeanor. You know, that's exactly how he looked.
That's super funny.
Well, it's funny because my dad graduated in 1958, and like he did tons of house calls, and we have his medical bag. Actually, I think we're going to put it. It was on display at our other studio, and it's super funny though because, you know, he passed away, and then this thing went into a storage locker, and then I went and emptied the storage locker with my sister, and it's like, you know, there's barbiturates in there, there's like vials of injectable barbiturate.
I think they were still, you know, all kinds Demerol, of narcotic pills, you know, tranquilizers for a horse. I mean, yeah,
it was wild because he would go to people's houses and they'd have a migraine and he would just inject them with, you know, Demerol, which is an opiate. It's basically morphine. And I sit there and I go, I mean, that was like Uber for heroin addicts. You know, you don't even have to go to the street. You just call somebody and they come to your house.
Well, hey, you know, thinking of what Vic said, I remember the same thing. Being a kid, because my mom had horrible migraines and would call up the doctor, you'd do a house call, you would be like your dad coming this bag, and she would get a bunch of shots for a migraine, you know, call up your Uber narcotic doc and away. Right. Yeah. But it was nuts what was in there. Yeah. I know. Anyway, I always think of, honestly, when we did house calls and then we saw some crazy stuff and that kind of came to an end as medicine changed. But I always think of the first, I call you guys the first responders, the police, the paramedics, and the fire department who go to people's homes all the time and see all kinds of stuff. Because, you know, we got a little glimpse of that, but it was like, oh my gosh, doing this all the time. And some of the things that, you know, that go on in people's homes, you get a real life glimpse into how people live.
Oh, well, in New York City, people abuse the system. And that's why in New York, we call the ambulance a bus.
Yeah.
Everywhere. Over the radio, it's like, put a rush on the bus, keep the bus rolling. We call it a bus because that's basically what it is. It just goes from A to B, and people just abuse it, and they're not going to pay for it. You know, if I called an ambulance to my house, I can guarantee you I would get a bill for over $1,000. You know, these yeah. people in the city, they're not paying for it. It just, you know, it's our tax dollars. And listen, after all the pre-med classes and you guys start beginning the hands-on training, you guys at some point were required to either do an autopsy or dissect a human cadaver, correct?
Yes. Yes. We.
Oh, that was a whole year.
I did it twice because I got an undergraduate degree in anatomy. Oh, so I did gross anatomy twice.
Well, wait. So back to what you were thinking, training.
Did an autopsy on a patient that she.
So you're not referring, Vic, to the actual gross anatomy class when we get a cadaver assigned to us and we, like in a groups of five, we literally dissect it from full corpse to, by the time we're done, it's just little pieces. Because
how did that affect you?
Three times. I mean, so we would be in there Wednesday afternoons from
it was terrible.
One to five. No, Wednesday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It was 3 days a week in the full afternoons for a whole year. That's gross anatomy lab. You also had more specific, like neuroanatomy, just for neural stuff. But so that was second year of med school. And, you know, that I think is a real turning point for dealing with bodies and death. It was for me, because after that, you like initially there's this shock moment of, you know, you get in pre-med, you get the little the pigs and the fish and the insects and just small little mammals. But when they wheel out a body and they open it up, and I'd never seen a dead body or anything embalmed like that before, it was shock. I mean, other than the field pigs we had in anatomy, biology. So it was very shocking. You know, there's the smell, the body.
Yeah,
the
smell is the formalin is like that. I can almost smell it now. My mother, I was still living at home, which I got a raft of shit from my colleagues for, but because I lived in the same city as I grew up, you know, went to medical school in the same town. And I told my mother, I said, don't ever make chicken sandwiches on these days of the week because it looks exactly the same color as what we were cutting apart.
Plus, it would seep into our clothes. And if we went to usually the med school kids would all hang out and go to the bar on Friday night together. And even after taking off the lab coats, and sometimes we would even change, as soon as we walked into the university bar, everybody would look at us and they're like, the med students are here because they could smell it. But back to I remember seeing that and just, you know, not even to describe in depth, but seeing someone, their skin's leathery, their arteries and veins are, you know, pumped full of colored, thick, gelatinous stuff. But the first time they unzip the bag, and the girl beside me, who was my friend in school, her eyes popped open and she went, oh my God, it's Mrs. Jones. And I'm like, what? And the professor comes running over. And so we went to school in Saskatchewan. It has less than 1 million people in it, in the whole province. She was from this small town. Mrs. Jones literally lived down the street for her when she grew up. So she sees Mrs. Jones' body lying there because she just recently passed, and she was mortified that we were going to have to, you know, she was going to have to dissect. So they readily moved swapped out bodies, got someone else. But I mean, that right then, that was like a, oh my gosh, this is a real person moment, right? But then as we started to get...
it doesn't last long, though, because like, there comes a point where
you start to get desensitized very quickly. Yeah. And after that, you know, bodies at that point to me were always shells of our real spirit person, because we looked at everything as, you know, a change.
But
it's just like you're a body.
Yeah.
We would do terrible things. We would take pieces and parts and put them in each other's lockers, like the heart, and hide it in someone's.
Yeah.
And that now like that would be, you would get charged with abuse.
You'd go to jail. No, you go to jail. But I mean, it's pretty, like, there is a lot of gallows humor when, like, you know, you go out with your buddies on a Friday night and they said, what did you do today? And it's like, I sawed a head in half with a hacksaw. And then.
But we
like,
did. We literally did. You'd have a bone saw. You'd have to cut it in half.
And then they give you directions.
And then it was very much like the reverse of putting IKEA furniture together in a Gross Anatomy. They give you exact directions about what to do and how to take things apart. And you become very numb to bodies.
The best was the pelvis, though, because you had to trade. So you had to do a male and a female pelvis. Because obviously, no matter what they say, they are actually different. So, you know, and the bodies are completely filled and soaked in formalin. Like it has to go absolutely everywhere, or else, you know, it's going to rot. Right. So we figured out really quickly, you get somebody in there. The human pelvis is unbelievably complicated. There's all these neurovascular bundles and you have to dissect them very carefully. So these guys would be down between, and we'd be, you know, trying to hold these super stiff legs apart so they could dissect the female pelvis. And then you would just reach into the abdomen and just kind of push on the bladder a little bit and it would squirt out formalin
onto the person's face that's at the bottom while the body's in this lithotomy.
It's like changing a diaper on a boy.
Yes, exactly. So we would do nasty things like that.
And then the guys that would come in, that would be the lab techs.
Oh.
They'd have one glove on in the body explaining something and then eating a sandwich with their other hand.
I've seen that.
Yeah. I mean,
it was nuts.
So then did we go to any death investigations in medical school?
I did.
That was when I did my first autopsy. Between second and third year. I did this little rural family medicine. It was an optional thing, rotation for a month, like a half an hour out of town. And I actually lived in a convent, slept there, and stayed at the, because it was, the hospital was run by the nuns, and that's another story. But
did they whack you with a ruler and tell you you had a filthy mouth?
I went to mass, and it was really, my knees were sore standing up and kneeling. But so I did, a lady passed in the hospital. She was elderly. But the physician on call, or no, actually the family doctor, that was her patient. The family doctor she was the patient of said to me, you know what? You're not probably going to get much more of a chance to do this. This is a rural practice in Canada and this is going to go away soon. We can do the autopsies here in the hospital. And they had a mortician in the hospital. We went downstairs to the morgue, literally, and we opened her up to figure out what she died from. And that was tough for me too, because I had actually seen her the night before she passed. And I was dealing with that as a, you know, mid-level med student, and was sad to see that. And then,
now
the cadaver is not the same as anatomy.
You're like 21, 22 years old.
Yeah. Well, at that point, because May started, I was 19 and a half at that
point. When she got into med. Yeah. So it's just, you know, it's like watching college football. You forget. It's like, these are children that are, you know, if they're 21, that's an older college football player. And we, you know, we watch this and it's like, how could you drop the ball? And it's like, because he's a kid, you know? And so you forget that. I mean, she was in my call group when we were interns, and she was 23 years old and she had already graduated from medical school. And wow. It was just, and it's just like, wow, you know, you get to do a lot of growing up, just, I mean, to deal with the stuff you're dealing with. And it was really pretty profound because you're really growing. I mean, you sacrifice your entire young adulthood to become a doctor. And that's just the way it is, because the training is so long. And back then, you know, we could do a year or 2 years and get into medical school. So, you know, if you graduated at 17, you could be in medical school when you were 18 or 19 years old. That doesn't happen now. People have a degree or an advanced degree. They go back. Some people don't start till they're 30 years old. I mean, I had my own patients, my own practice, and had moved to another country, and I was 29 years old.
I got a funny story about that. One of my old partner's parents were from Romania. So at a high school, he went to high school in the Bronx. His parents says, all right, you're going to be a doctor. we're going to send you to live with Uncle Gilas and, you know, Aunt Dora in Romania. And he had been there once or twice, but he wasn't tight with these people. And his parents send him off to live with his cousins. So, you know, this is before the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, and it's everything. The school he's going to was like an old Soviet barracks. And he's in medical school, and he quickly realizes he can make money by selling blue jeans and cigarettes that he's having sent over from the United States. He's got a little business going, but he's the outsider, and he speaks Romanian, but it's not his first language. So, you know, he sounds awkward, and the kids are making fun of him, and a lot of the people in this class are older than him. So he's, you know, low on the pecking order. So one day they bring out bodies, and like you guys said, they're dissecting them. And I guess after whatever day it was, the professor tells him, go get that wheelbarrow over there and put all the arms and legs in the wheelbarrow and bring it down to the incinerator and burn them. And he goes, what are you fucking kidding me? And he's like, no. And they all leave. He says, so I'm, you know, he goes, I'm putting arms and legs and body parts in a wheelbarrow. He goes, I go into this old freight elevator. He goes, I go downstairs. He goes, there's some Igor guy there. Oh, good, good. Bring next wheelbarrow. He goes, he was on the phone the next day with his parents or that night, like, get me the fuck out of here. He goes, there's arms and legs going in different directions in the wheelbarrow. He goes, it was like a horror movie. And then he became a cop.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then it became an actual horror movie after that.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, I got some medical questions. Have you guys, I know you guys were in a rural area. Did you ever have any horrific, like, stabbings or gunshot wounds?
Yes. Oh, heck, come on. How do you think you almost got arrested by the police?
Oh, this is a great story.
And I had a stabbing that was stupid, but go ahead.
This is a great story. This would be good for your, what is it, Derelicts and Dipshits or whatever your book is? Or
both.
Dumbass.
Dickheads and Debauchery.
Yeah. So I'm on call, just general call for the hospital. And I get a call from the scrub nurse in the OR. And she says, you have to come as fast as you can. And, you know, the surgeon that was doing surgery, he's like, this guy, we have like a high velocity gunshot wound to the guy's groin. And it wasn't because he was, you know, in a gun battle. It was because he was cleaning his gun and somehow put the barrel of like a 308 in his groin and damn near blew his leg up. I mean, it was so at that point I had just recently purchased my first Corvette and they said, come as fast as you can. So I drove.
Oh, so he stops. He gets off the phone. This is Tim, because if you know Tim and how much he loves to drive his Corvettes, he gets off the phone and he looks at me and goes, the hospital called him on call and they said to me, come as fast as you can. And he had this big shit eating grin on his face because I'm like, oh shit. They don't realize what they said to him because it's like a 20-mile drive.
So it's 20-mile drive, but it's, you know, it's rural Oregon, 4-lane highway. It's, you know, it's evening, it's summertime. There's, you know, basically no cars. Well, so I'm drifting through town, like literally drifting this car, and I get it out onto the highway and I'm going 150 miles an hour for, you know, the 20 miles. Yes. I get into the next town where the hospital is and there's a roadblock and holy shit, are they pissed? Like they, you know, the guy had his mag light out, turned around like a club, you know, who are you? And, you know, all, and I just said, hey, this is the deal. Like, this is really serious. We got to go. So they followed me into the hospital. I got out, I ran inside. I went into the operating room. I looked back and the ambulance was leaving and the cops talked to the, you know, nothing ever happened.
But the patients knew what happened. Your patients knew.
One of my patients has a scanner and him and his wife were debating on whether I'd actually get a ticket. And he's like, he's not going to get a ticket. He's a doctor. But the thing that was crazy, like, so this guy's just, it's like hamburger, like his groin. And, you know, we're doing vascular surgery in this little dinky town. I think we wiped out our blood bank. We gave him all of the O negative blood that we had. And, you know, so he hadn't had perfusion to his foot for, I don't know how long. And generally that actually increases your mortality risk, like your risk of dying just from a massive blood clotting problem that happens when you get too much transfused blood. And so we buttoned the guy up. We got, you know, we got a pulse back in his foot and sewed his femoral artery back together. And basically all the muscles, you just kind of laid there. and let them just kind of heal up how they're going to do. Got one of the orthopedic surgeons in to take a look and put this guy in the ICU, watched him overnight, sent him up to Portland the next day to the, you know, tertiary care trauma center. And they did nothing for the guy. They just like looked at him. They said, yeah, he's fine. They observed him for four or five more days. And he was, not only did we save his life, he didn't get his leg or foot amputated, which I thought was completely miraculous.
But
speeding does save lives. That's the message everyone needs to know.
I was just quickly, trying to think through all the things. And there's been a lot. I mean, some of them are silly and some of them are horrific. But I worked in a different where we lived in a small town. And somebody got into a bar fight, but it was at McDonald's. I think it was a drug deal gone bad. And they walked to McDonald's to where the clinic was about a good half mile away, leaving this blood trail that the police later found because someone said they got stabbed with a plastic knife, but they walked in and they had, you know, a flailing chest, a big gaping hole. And I was like, you got to go to the hospital. No, we can't, you know, because they didn't want to get the police to come
there.
There was what little that I could do at 7 o'clock at night in this little town family practice clinic.
And he's trying to tell you he got stabbed with a spork.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, exactly right.
Yeah, can't pull that bullshit on me. But then, you know, we had things, you know, when I was a resident, we worked in this small town in rural Canada and saw all kinds of stuff. I got called out to a mine, this open pit mine.
Oh,
and
my
a guy
gosh.
Had been working and a big piece of equipment up on almost a crane for drilling fell down and hit him on the head. And the miners, their first thing, you know, they call for the backup physicians to come, but they're all trained in, you know, basic life support. So they can't stop doing anything till we get there. So we fly in the helicopter. We get out. We go, me and the staff physician that are primary, that's on first call. And they're doing CPR on this guy and his skull is literally blown off and every compression, you know, is pumping blood out of his head and his brains are all over but they couldn't stop, you know, that kind of stuff. And I also saw someone was mowing the lawn without shoes on. They had flip flops on.
And I had one of those.
Backed up and ran over all their toes. And I was also a student on this other rotation. The family physician was amazing. He's like, okay, you know, it's like two hours to the city hospital, or we can do the best we can on the weekend. This is back in the days, right? The late 80s. And let's sew these guys' toes back on and you're going to learn how to sew tendons. And we did this total repair. The guy had all these broken toes. We had learned how to suture tendons and he kept, I think, all of them, but one little pinky kind of sloughed off. I remember that. And then we saw nutty accidents of all kinds. We need to write a book on all the things.
The worst case I ever had, though, was I was actually a final or second, I think final year medical student. I was in a rural community and we had a 9-year-old that shot himself with a shotgun.
Yeah, that's horrible.
Which
stuff.
Was like, just like, how does that happen to a kid that age? But I mean, it happens. You hear those stories and, you know, we went into the house because we didn't know if it was going to be, you know, the ambulance called us and they said, we need a physician here. So myself and the attending went. And as soon as we left the hospital, they said, send the coroner, which he was at that same time, which is interesting because we actually, when we moved to Oregon, we actually ended up doing death investigations to help out the county coroner, who was also a family practice doc. So we got trained in that and saw all sorts of, that was crazy. All sorts of wild stuff. You know, what happens to two kids on meth when they drive 45 miles an hour being chased by several different jurisdictions of police officers and then decide to hit a 150-foot tall Douglas fir tree. It ends poorly.
Yeah.
Speaking of drugs, have you guys ever had to administer Narcan to an overdose victim?
Oh, yes. The last one I did. I was so mad. Because it was a fellow colleague that had kind of accidentally overdosed this patient by stacking too many, giving her too many narcotics. And she had a lot of other health risks. But I was working in urgent care and this lady came in and she was acting all loopy. She was in her like late 70s, early 80s. And then I saw her med list and she she was kind of half with it, and all of a sudden she totally goes out, and I'm like starting to think, well, I'm like, well, look at her med list, let's give her Narcan. And then she came around really quick. That was like the last one, which I was totally frosted, because then I called up my colleague and like, this lady, look, the list of narcotics you got her on. And she's like in her 70s, and he's like, oops. But
yeah, I'm trying to think.
I've never really done like an,
because we're not in the field.
No, we're not in the field, but that would have been the last, like the only real one I ever used.
But the other one that's really interesting is Ramazacon. So Ramazacon is the essentially the Narcan for benzodiazepines. So if you have a patient on benzos, you know, too much Xanax, too much Valium, whatever, you can actually reverse that, which is amazing. So we had this patient in the ICU, and I had my medical student with me, and we didn't have a, you know, we're like, what the hell's going on with this guy? And he seems more or less in a coma, but not really in a coma. He's breathing on his own. He's not very arousable. So we're like, okay, well, maybe he had too many benzos. So it's like, get me the Ramazacon. So the nurse brings in the syringe, and I put it into this guy's IV port, and I push it in there. And the medical student, like, you could, like, he almost shit his pants, because this guy just like comes back to life.
Yes.
And it's like, well, I guess that's what it was, you know.
It's the most amazing thing. If you know, my listeners out there, go on YouTube and see what happens when an overdose victim is giving a shot of Narcan. The first time I saw it, I was a rookie cop. I was in the Franklin Avenue men's shelter, which was an old armory. It was just beds, hundreds of beds with homeless people, and most of them are mentally ill, and they yell. It's like an insane asylum. And you know, some guy went off the reservation and came back with a couple of bags of dope, did one bag too many. And we got there, he's laying there, his eyes are rolled up to his head. There's that foam shit coming out of his nose and mouth. Doesn't have a pulse. The EMTs came over, there was cool as cucumbers, and they just gave him a shot of that Narcan, and it was like that movie Ghost. He's like, fucking guy just jumped up, and he's, because what it, you guys know this, what it does is it basically neutralizes the opiates in your system. So you go from the greatest high in the world, which is going to kill you, to instant withdrawal. Now all of a sudden they're dope sick. They're, you know, it's the hallucinations, it's the stomach cramps, the runs, the vomiting, and it just takes their high away. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, I had never seen anything like that before. And it's like one of the most amazing drugs in the world. But, and I didn't know that they had something for benzos.
Yeah, it doesn't work as well, but when we hit that guy with it, it worked absolutely amazing. And that's the problem now, because now we're getting into these synthetic opioids, which nothing works. Which is, you know, xylazine is that, I don't know if you've read anything about that, but there's so much now entering the system that isn't fentanyl. It's xylazine. It's harder to test for. It gives you basically the similar high, same respiratory depression, all the things that kill you in an opiate overdose, but Narcan doesn't do anything.
So it's like a designer drug.
Yeah, it's not even a synthetic opioid. It literally is like a horse tranquilizer that somehow, I'm sure it's being manufactured, you know, illicitly in the super labs in Mexico, like everything else is. And, it can fly a little bit more under the radar than fentanyl, which is why fentanyl is so effective, because you can smuggle so much, so little of it and still sell a ton of product. So the way to hide it, like, I mean, it makes sense, you know.
I was,
have you
just
guys ever had to deal with anybody under the influence of angel dust?
No,
we were when we arrived in rural Oregon, it was just the beginning of the explosion of meth.
Mm-hmm.
So
saw lots of people methed out coming in all the time.
So the whole, like, PCP and all that was kind of out of vogue. And actually, so was heroin. Heroin was not an issue until after we prescribed a gazillion, you know, opiates to people over who knows how many years. And then, you know, and then that kind of got into the system. And then
we started seeing it in the mid.
But if you, you know, I could talk
15, 16, and the kids are in high school. They're like, yeah, people are into heroin now. It's easier to get than, no one wants Ritalin or opioids. They just do heroin.
Yeah, and it's interesting because these cycles are fairly well established. Like, I remember growing up in the 70s and even the really early 70s when I was in elementary school, and it was, you know, LSD and heroin. And then that kind of went away. I didn't even know what methamphetamine was. I mean, other than, you know, just uppers, you know, pills. And then you got into the crystal meth era where they were manufacturing it. And we actually had people, because they loved the logging roads, like there's these abandoned logging roads with no locks on them. So they could build a mobile meth lab in Oregon and they could take it out into the woods and never be found and never have the stink or the, you know, blowing up your house and all of that stuff. And
it
so
sounds like
they would literally
Walt and Jesse go out into an Indian reservation, basically 40 miles off the road in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly. And they said, they were like, why did you move here? And they're like, well, because I can cook here and I don't get in trouble. And we're like, why are you telling me this?
Yeah. One of the weirdest overdoses that I ever saw, I'll never forget this and don't really know how it ended, but was when we were also in this, doing our rural training for 4 months in the middle of Canada. This lady came in and to ER. And when you're on family practice, whatever day, we all rotate with call. So my preceptor that I was with, you know, he's on ER call. So that meant you go to the, you know, work, go to the office 9 to 5, you'd round on your patients first in the hospital. And then 9 to 5, you see your patients in office. And then at 5 o'clock, 5:30, well, maybe you get to eat. You're on call for the ER from, you know, 5 till people stop coming. Hopefully you can clean it up and get home early and go to bed. So you would go to the hospital and do call there because there was no staff ER docs in these little towns.
Yeah,
but
so if they
the
needed
family practice docs did it.
Yeah. So this is, yeah, okay.
So what happened was it was, you know, 6 o'clock at night and we get called to the ER to do, because there's a few patients there, some kid with a broken arm, and some lady gets wheeled in by the paramedics. She's unconscious and she's probably 60, 65 years old-ish. And we're like, huh, this is interesting, because her oxygen was good, her heart rhythm was normal. So, you know, we check her blood sugar, because that's the first thing you're also thinking, you know, what's their blood sugar? Do they need some glucose? They had given that in the field. Nothing happened. We do blood work. We have a limited blood panel to check her electrolytes. Those all look okay. And so at that point, it's like they don't have an access to urine toxicology screen, but we start asking questions. You can do basic urine screen, ask the family questions. No, she doesn't drink. She doesn't take anything. And so we gather up like all her meds, and the nearest tertiary care center was like 2.5 hours away.
Oh, at least. Yeah. At least.
So the ambulance, we're like, get her out of here, get her into the city. Well, this lady had been, she had a back injury. And been rubbing A535, which is basically like Biofreeze or any of the Aspir cream or muscle rub, what's some other, Bengay, there you go, on her body so much, and she was obese, that she had rubbed so much on it, soaked into her fat and absorbed it, and she couldn't metabolize it. And I was just quickly looking because I couldn't remember like what the main products, but menthol was the big one. There's also salicylates, wintergreen. She put herself into a coma from the menthol that toxified. And it took them a long time doing this tox stuff in the city because we finally heard back. She's like, yeah, she rubbed herself with so much Bengay, she put herself into a coma because she couldn't metabolize stuff. She lived and did all right.
Bengay coma. Yeah. That one's
good. I was like, what the hell?
That was that same town where I showed up and these two kids came in and they said, we're not sure what we're supposed to do. And they're teenagers. And we're like, what do you mean? And they said, somebody told us that what we did might have been dangerous, but we feel perfectly fine. And we're like, what did you do? And they said, we had a Tylenol eating contest.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
eating.
So like they ate like, I don't know, like they each ate like 100 pills of Tylenol. And so, you know, the problem with Tylenol is it has this huge therapeutic window. You can take 10 times of the 10 times the regular dose before it becomes close to lethal. Well, they probably had 150 times the lethal dose. And they said, well, how can this possibly kill us? It's over the counter. And I'm like, dipshit, you can drink water till you die.
You can drink
so
bleach.
You can drown. Hello. You can do, there's lots of things that are, you know, you need for survival that you can kill you. So, and they're just looking at us and we're like, yeah, because what happens with this is you're going to be perfectly fine, perfectly fine. In 2 or 3 days, you're going to have absolutely overwhelming liver failure and you're going to die in hours. And they're like, what? So there is N-acetylcysteine is the antidote. Mucamist, and you give massive IV doses of this stuff and you watch their liver enzymes and you pray to God that it works, and it worked and they were fine. And, you know, but it's just like,
yeah,
the dipshittery is amazing.
Oh, there's there's a lot of funny things that people called in. I was thinking about the turkey baster.
Oh, well, yeah. Vic was going to ask a question.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
We'll go to the turkey baster. That sounds more interesting than what I was going to ask you.
So the turkey baster, so this, one of our actually very good friend of ours, helped take care of our kids at various times and just a really, really great friend of ours. And she's probably 15, 20 years younger than us. So she was starting out as a medical assistant in the office, and she gets a call, right? They would field the calls and then they would, send the call, either answer it or ask the doctor a question or whatever. And this guy calls up and says, I need some help. And it's like, okay, what's the problem? Well, my wife can't get pregnant. And because my sperm count is basically zero, I had, a logging injury or something. So we have her on the kitchen table right now, and my buddy's here, and we're going to fill the turkey baster, and we want to know how far we're supposed to stick it in. And she looks up the phone, and she just goes, stop! And she hung the phone up.
Like,
did they call back?
I don't know.
She went running to whoever was the primary care doctor.
And then the primary care doctor actually, I think, called them back, and it's like, dude, no moss.
It wasn't a prank?
No, it was not a prank.
Oh, no, it was not a prank.
For real. All kinds of fun stuff like that.
See, I thought cops on patrol were the only ones that saw ridiculous things. But yeah, I'm guessing at some point or another, it gets filtered into the emergency room.
Yeah, well, people would show up at this small town urgent care thinking, oh, urgent care can fix everything, where it's like a mini ER, and it is literally like a glorified, basically we could do suturing and fractures and take out foreign bodies, but they would come with ridiculousness. Like people would fall two stories from a building and practically, splat their head open, and their significant other brings them in and like, oh, they just fell out of a window three stories high. I'm like, go to the hospital. I had this little kid. Oh, it was the end of the day. People would come in with this horrific things. Someone got their face mauled horribly by a dog. Their lips, nose hanging off. I'm like, what are you doing here? Someone in labor, practically having the baby there. We have another labor story. But this little kid, it was like right 5 minutes before closing on a probably weekend night, 5 minutes to eight. And the mom was texting and she was really mad because we were behind. And the girl had this cover over her eye, and she told the receptionist when she checked in that her daughter got hit in the eye and got a scratch on her eye from playing outside. Well, no one checked anything. They're just like, okay, have a seat. Wait your turn. The girl comes back. The nurse puts her down and doesn't want to touch any bandages because, they wouldn't do it until the doctor got in. The girl is quiet. She's 5 years old. And she's like, am I going to be okay? I pull the bandage back. She literally has a giant stick sticking 3 to 4 inches out of her globe, the whole eye. It's stuck in there. And the mom's still texting.
Did she cross her heart and hope to die? Yeah.
And the mom is pissed at me because I said, oh my goodness, you're going to have to go to the hospital. I'll call the emergency doc and then also get the ophthalmologist to meet.
You don't even have to go to the hospital. You have to go to the freaking operating room and have an eye surgeon deal with that. Yeah. And it's like, and then, no. Can't you just take it out here?
And then
like, dinner reservations.
Pissed. She's calling her husband. This is a worthless, stupid clinic. They can't even do anything. And now we have to go to the hospital to pay another bill. Oh my lady.
Her kid's going to lose her eye.
The kid
and she's bent out of shape that you're sending her to the right place to get it done.
And that happened a lot, but it was sad because we followed up on that, and the child did lose her eye. It was sad.
Oh, Christ, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Speaking of not wanting to go to the hospital, my friend's father, when I was a kid, was like a knock around guy from the neighborhood, and he used to go to these illegal card games and stuff. And I guess there was a fight at this card game. A gun came out and he gets shot in the foot. So, you get shot in the foot in a mob card game, you're not going to go to the emergency room because then the cops are going to come and they're going to start asking questions. So, the way the mob is, he probably went to a dentist and the guy pulled a fucking bullet out of his foot. So my friend noticed that his dad, his back was bothering me. He goes, Dad, I thought you got shot in the foot. He goes, when the guy was pulling the bullet out of my foot, I jumped and I threw out my back.
Of course.
Because they had him on some table. I found this story out years after it happened. The guy walked with a limp for the rest of his life, but he said, yeah, he goes, he was like on a table, like on a, they had him like on a pool table. And, you know, one of the guys there was a dentist and he's like, oh yeah, I got this. And they pulled a small caliber bullet out of his foot. And when he jerked, he threw out his back.
Jeez. Well, we've seen a lot of, I wouldn't say bullet injuries. It was a weird one. The guy came in and he was complaining that he had a headache and his temple hurt and he had been cleaning his gun too, some air thing. Well, we did an x-ray of his head and there's a bullet lodged right behind his eye. Like
a BB.
Yeah. And I'm like, and so then it was like, well, were you really doing, that was bizarre.
Right. But, it's like all the butt stuff, right? Like you, so we've seen, so you so- sat down, you sat down and somehow magically the entire Coke bottle just inhaled up your
rear. Or the golf ball you accidentally sat on. I saw that one and we delivered.
A guy had a golf ball up his ass?
Yeah, as a woman. No, a golf ball up her vagina that she sat on. Mm-hmm.
Accidentally.
Her and her husband, who was he was concerned very much more than she was.
Well, as a titleist, came in. And yes. those are pricey,
you know. But one night we turned this, we kind of mocked this because this lady came in and screamed it to the whole waiting room that she had something in her vagina that shouldn't be there, and it was stuck, and she had some mental health issues. But basically, she had put some nail polish bottle, I should say, in her vagina, but she's a very large woman. And this thing got turned around backwards so that the top of the nail polish bottle was up closest to this cervix. So the bottom, you know, where you'd have the glass and the name of the nail polish is on the facing. So I'm looking
What color was the nail polish?
I'll tell you in a minute. But I can't get it with my tools, my ringed forceps, because it's glass, it's slippery. She's very large, so there's a lot of intravaginal pressure pushing things in. I had a nurse helping me, and I'm trying to get this. So then I think, okay, I'm just going to do it like a delivery. I'll put my fingers in. I'll try to get this thing out. Well, I have very short fingers. Part of the reason I did not do obstetrics, because it made it difficult for me. I am almost abusing this lady trying to get this thing out. So I call my partner. He's a younger guy that was our resident that we helped train. He comes in. I'm like, Sam, you know, you got to help me out because – and he's like, yeah, okay. Anyway, meanwhile, the nurse is mortified because this lady is talking about all kinds of electrical energy.
She's awake.
Oh, she's awake. And she's talking about, you know, the currents coming through the room and you know, all how she felt while she was putting this nail polish bottle in there. And I'm like, lady, there's other things for this.
Save it. Yeah.
We finally got this thing out and we put the tools in the sink. The nail polish was a sparkly purple color. I think it said sparkle whatever on it. And we put it all in the sink. We like, okay, honey, you're good to go. Go home. Everybody could hear everything. So you're kind of like, she's okay. We leave and we go back to clean up the room. And we called it little sparkle. We delivered baby sparkle, you know, 2 ounces, blah, blah, blah. Well, I go in the room and I said to the nurse, I'm like, oh my gosh. I'm like, it's gone. The nail polish is gone. She had taken it home with her. Because all the equipment, the speculum, the forceps, everything we'd thrown in there with it but the nail polish was gone. So,
well, she had to take her baby home.
She did. But we had a guy that was a frequent flyer to the ER as well as urgent care that was notorious. He was also crazy, but would like to put things in his rectum and then come in to have medical staff extract it because he got off on that. And he'd just literally been to the ER, and I think they were trying to call to warn us, but he would show up in urgent care, and it was like women weren't really allowed to go in there. We had some male nurses and a PA we worked with. It was a guy and
I worked in that facility numerous times and I never had to.
And he would come in there and the door, they had to legally leave, they would leave the door open but pull the curtain, and then you could hear the drawers opening, see his pants drop, stuff, you know, all the time. And I'm like, what is it with people? I didn't go in there, I sent in things like people do things to themselves
where I think if I was by myself on a deserted island for 100 million years, I would never think of doing that.
Yeah, it wouldn't occur to you.
Yeah, it would never cross my mind.
Really weird shit where I'm like, why are you telling me this? I don't want to know.
No, I don't want to know because now I can't unknow it. Thank you for just.
I think it's for attention. And like you said, it's the thrill of them going up there and retrieving it and the attention they're getting of everyone's hovering around.
Yeah.
And they're well aware of, you know, it's not like you went in there for, you know, an ingrown toenail.
No, there's a lot of
one person. They know there's going to be a room full of people wanting to see how this is done.
Well, and there's a lot of psych pathology and some of that stuff for sure. Yeah. And then there's all the innocent things. A kid, you know, kids put things in their nose and ears and things that shouldn't be there and etc. But yeah, there's a lot of crazy pathology, sadly.
Oh, yeah, swallowing coins, that's a big one in kids because that's
up. He was always in the emergency room.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm a huge proponent or fan of cryotherapy, and we're going to go into quackery.
Oh boy.
So I go for cold treatments in a sub-zero temperature. It's usually 145 degrees for 3.5 minutes. Right. So when I go in, it's like a big refrigerated room with a glass door and you put on earphones. For a guy, you go in with a pair of Crocs, a pair of shorts, a pair of gloves, a mask over your mouth so you're not inhaling the ice cold air, and a hat. And I go in for 3.5 minutes a day. And the reason I started going is my back was killing me. And I was going to a chiropractor for over a year, 2 treatments a week, and it did absolutely nothing for me. Since I started doing the cryotherapy, my back doesn't bother me anymore, and I still play sports. And I think that it helps with the recovery time of running and working out. Have you guys have any experience with cryotherapy? Do you think it's quackery?
Well, it doesn't. I'll tell you right now, it doesn't matter. Because unless it's dangerous, if it works, who cares what it is? So, you know, we've gone down a ton of rabbit holes in the last year, and there's stuff that I never thought in a million years I'd believe that I actually looked into, and I go, wow, there may not be perfect evidence, but this really seems to help people. And so, I mean, I think the proof is in the pudding, and whether there's a study or it's blinded or it's placebo or it's whatever, it doesn't matter. If it works for you and it's not dangerous and not insanely expensive, who cares? I mean, most allopathic physicians would say it's quackery, but most allopathic physicians would tell you to get a COVID shot every 6 months, which is complete Russian roulette.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
So
I think the cryotherapy is really a way.
I think it's
cold
a real
plunge,
thing.
Like messing with your cold shock proteins, and we know that cold exposure, short periods like that, is actually really helpful. It's supposed to be great for, you know, well,
that was my second
longevity.
Question. Do you guys see a downside to that?
Frostbite.
I wouldn't lick a metal pole
while you're in there.
No, but I mean, like exposing yourself 3-4 times a week to that, you don't see a downside to it?
Only if you have a medical condition such as like Raynaud's, vascular disease with poor circulation, that kind of a thing. So yeah, for you, if you don't have that, no, but someone like me who truly, I can't do the colds because I would lose my fingertips.
So yeah. The question is, why not just use the tub?
Yeah.
I don't have a tub. It's just easy for me. I just go in there and they've got a lot of stuff. And the next question I was going to ask, they also do red light therapy. Have you heard of that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's not quackery at all. There's a lot of data and stuff on that. And some of it, the fringes of using it sometimes gets a little bit nutty. Like we hear of people say, you know.
Yeah. And
maybe stare into the red light. And even though you're supposed to.
Yeah,
technically wear the glasses to protect your eyes. So this, who was it that was saying? We heard this podcast.
Oh, that was Gary Brecka
talking about. He actually will stare into the red light while he's in the bed, and his vision's great. And
I think,
but red light therapy has a lot of uses.
Yes,
for sure.
There's you know data, and again, the data is only as good as the data is. But the problem with it is the issue is that it's not regulated, and I'm a big.
No.
Anti-regulation guy, generally speaking, but there's a reason why we have those regulations. And so not all red light therapy is the same.
Exactly.
You know, like, you know, Gary Brecka, who's one of the, you know, kings of this therapy, you know, he built his own unit and it has 45,000, you know, red light diodes in it. You know, it's like a
$200,000 bed.
No, it's a $250,000 bed. So that's completely different as far as what that's going to do for total body red light compared to, you know, a lot of the commercial beds that you see in, you know, health spas. I think the targeted therapy with really good, small light boxes is super helpful. You know, you have a knee problem, you have these, and none of that is inexpensive. Like to buy those is very expensive, actually. It's surprising.
Yeah, like a little unit. I was looking at getting one for my hip and my elbow stuff. It was like $1,200 for the, you know, the light and the battery pack. I mean, they're not inexpensive at all. There's other things though. I mean, hyperbaric therapy. I wouldn't call that quackery. I've used it a whole lot, and it's the it's an amazing thing for wound healing at low pressures, as well as orthopedic injuries, recovery from stroke and brain injury. They use it in cancer recovery from chemos and things.
They've also said that the hyperbaric chamber might be good for Alzheimer's or the early stages of it or dementia.
Yep.
Well, if you really want to, your mind exploded about Alzheimer's, I can't remember what episode it is, because we're up to almost 200 episodes. But we have four, with Dr. Sabine Hazen, who's the world's foremost authority on the gut microbiome, probably the world's number one expert on stool transplantation, where you actually take somebody else's crap and using a colonoscope. They used to infuse the crap through your nose, through a nasogastric tube into your upper GI tract. So you literally did like a snooter of somebody else's shit. Like that's
why,
because to seed the gut, you have to seed it high enough. You can't just take poop and put it in somebody's colon. They'll just poop it out and the bacteria won't make a home there. So you have to, they used to think that you had to seed it just below the stomach, like in the ileum or the, you know, the top of the ileum.
Beginning of the small intestine. When we were residents, but now, they would do that. They would infuse these. Oh, it was horrible.
But they can, they got so good with colonoscopes that you can actually seed it into the cecum, the bottom of the small bowel, and it works. But the story she tells, because people will come in with this bacterial overgrowth called C. diff, and it's a potentially very dangerous. It can cause a colitis that will kill you. It can be a lethal diarrhea. And so certain people, there's antibiotics that it doesn't work. And the only hope really for survival is a stool transplant. So they type the donor. It's usually a family member, and they treat this C. diff infection, because, you know, that's the only FDA approved indication for this. So they do this. Okay, that's fine and good. But what happened is she did so many of these, people have other problems, you know, like, you know, somebody's profoundly depressed, or somebody has really significant Alzheimer's disease, or whatever the case may be. And she does these stool transplants, and their C. diff goes away, and their other medical problems get better. So she had a patient she talked about, and I think she actually presented this at a couple conferences. So she had a patient that came in who was profoundly demented. Like his mini mental status exam was, I think, like 10 or 11, and that's out of 30. So if you're 25 or less, you're pretty disabled. If you're under 20, I mean, he couldn't remember his daughter's name, like his grown, you know, 50-year-old daughter's name. So Dr. Hazen transplants this guy, and she sees him in follow-up 3 or 4 months later, because she wants to make sure that his stool transplant still worked and his symptoms are better. And somebody retested him, and his mini mental status exam was 29. It was almost completely normal. He knows everyone's name. Like his daughter just starts weeping the first time she saw him, you know, a couple months after. He walks into the room and she's like, hey, how are the kids?
Normal, but it got significantly
better. No, it was almost normal. It was not normal. Yeah. She did not cure this guy's Alzheimer's. And the thing is, the thing that's really, we really love about Dr. Hazen is she's like, I don't know why this works. Like she doesn't, like, it's like,
well, she's honest.
Yeah.
She's honest. She goes, I don't know why this works, but I've seen, you know, people with like going from absolutely horrific stool profiles to normal with a transplant, and their profound depression goes away, or they lose weight, or they, like, it's just, it's really, really crazy, the whole gut microbiome. And we're really at the very beginning of research. And she's the first person to admit that, like, we're at the very beginning of this. Like, we don't really know the mechanisms. We just know that if you have certain bugs, you're healthier than if you have other bugs.
But don't eat bugs or poop.
No,
don't eat poop. That's bad.
No friggin' way.
Don't get a turkey baster and do something with it. at home.
Oh God, no. But that red light therapy, like I said, the first time I saw it, I thought it was quackery because you go in this tanning bed and you get out and you feel like a day old wiener at the 7-Eleven. And I'm like, what did I just do to myself? Like, I'm laying in this thing, you know, every time I visit the Red Planet, I don't do it as much as cryotherapy, but I'll do it once or twice a month. But you guys do see benefits with that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the real benefit is probably very prolonged. Like you have to do it for quite a while, mm-hmm. over a longer period of time. I think acutely, I think the same is with hyperbaric oxygen. I think hyperbaric oxygen clearly does something because, you know, the hospital systems are into these hyperbaric chambers because they make them piles of money because they're great for non-healing wounds. But those are high pressures. Like they're doing a couple atmospheres. Whereas
the low pressure beds
are maybe half an atmosphere, and then you're breathing 100% oxygen. So essentially it's like being 10 feet underwater. So it's very low pressure, but it's just enough to, the explanation is to dissolve the oxygen in your plasma. And that is unbelievably anti-inflammatory. And that's the key, is that you're just changing. It's not, you know, you're not hyperoxygenating, you know, necessarily. You are hyperoxygenating your tissues, but it's just enough pressure at just enough dose of oxygen that it has this anti-inflammatory effect. And it's really, really quite amazing. Like every time I come out of one in an hour of that, I'm like, my vision is 25 years better.
Yeah, I can feel the difference. But it's meant to be used regularly, stacked, just like you do any other therapy. You know, you don't go to physical therapy one time and think your tendonitis is better. So same thing with hyperbarics. But I'm a big proponent of that.
Do they have to bring you out slow? And can you get could you get the bends? I mean, if they got you out too quick?
There's not enough pressure. You need bends. You need, I've treated one patient, which is insane because this was 75 miles away from the Pacific Ocean.
Oh, this is a funny story.
But the guy got the bends, picking up sunglasses in 30 feet of water. So he figured out where all the ski boats park in the lake, and people like, oh, look in the water, bloop, and their sunglasses go in. So he figured this location out. And he went in when the water was cold and no one was in the lake. And he was just like up and down, up and down, up and down. So he burned through an entire tank. So he had probably been in the water, you know, well over an hour, and he had no surface interval. And he had probably like 7 or 8 30 foot to surface.
So he didn't pay attention to his time.
So he wasn't playing and depth, you know, looking at the dive charts. Tables. And then he ran out of air. So then when he ran out of air, he was at 30 feet and he just corked. So then he comes into me and he's like, I got the bends. And I'm like, you're not getting the bends. Like, no freaking ocean here. Like, what are you doing? And so he's like, no, it's in my left shoulder. And so I researched it and I'm like, it's a clinical diagnosis. Like, there's no test. You can't do a nitrogen test to see if he has had nitrogen bubbles because they'll all be long gone. And I looked at it and I'll be damned. The most common presentation is left shoulder pain. It happens within, you know, a minute or 2 minutes of surfacing or whatever it was. I can't remember the details. And this guy, like, he fit the clinical picture perfectly. We had a hyperbaric chamber for wound healing, so we could take this guy to like 3, 4, 5 atmospheres if we had to, because it was a hard unit. So I called up the hyperbaric chamber, and you would have thought these guys won the lottery. I mean, they're treating something that's, you know, potentially life-saving. It's not, you know, so grandma with a wound on her left butt cheek.
Yeah.
And
bring him in.
And it's took,
like, this is cool.
It was wild. It took, I think,
sessions, 2 weeks.
Oh, it took 2 or 3 days of multiple sessions before he was normal. That's like, right. It was insane. Like, don't get the bends. Like, it's not a good thing.
No, I don't dive. I wouldn't do that crap. It's just, but when you're talking about pressure, that's the first thing I thought of, is getting the bends. And you were talking about plasma, and I give blood regularly. I probably give it about 3-4 times a year. Is there a benefit to that as far as for your health, giving blood?
Only if you produce too much, which there are certain conditions where people do, to make, you know, they have higher, high iron levels. They have a lot, hyperviscous blood because they produce too much. So those people are bled regularly. But for the people that fall in the normal range,
if you give it to Lance Armstrong, there's clearly a benefit.
if you're,
but there's not a downside of giving blood a couple of times a year, is there?
Oh no,
no, not at all.
And if not, no, assuming that you're normal, like you don't have a disease,
right?
You know, hematologic, right? You know,
yeah, no downside.
And for some people, like men on TRT, on testosterone replacement therapy, that tends to jack up your bone marrow a little bit, so it can actually be a little bit helpful because you make more red blood cells. So taking a little bit off the top, everyone skimming the cream off the top is not a bad thing, so to speak.
Yeah.
They're always asking me to donate plasma, and A, it takes longer, and B, I'm just not thrilled. Like, I don't mind giving blood, but I've watched people, you know, give plasma, and it's going through a machine where everyone else's blood has gone through, and then they're getting it back, and I'm like, I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. No, yes, I hear you. It's like, cause our entire family's O negative. So, you know, they're calling us all the time for blood donation, and they do that same thing. Cause they can do the double removal where they get, you know, 4 units of packed red cells instead of whole blood, but by giving you your plasma back, and you look at the machine, you're kind of like, yeah.
No, thanks.
And where I am, they have these like mobile blood centers. You know what I mean? And they ask you all these questions about were you in the UK eating beef? And I'm like, they're wondering if I got the mad cow syndrome, right? And I mean, there's just so many, have you paid to have sex in the last 6 months? And I'm like,
if that's
what they're worried about, that's coming through this center, I'm not running my blood through this centrifuge crap or whatever it is to get it back. I don't mind giving it, but I'm not into recycling. Sorry. Can't do it. Can't help you.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure it's safe, but I thought a lot of things were safe that I don't think are safe anymore. So there's that, you know, there's that. Maybe they'll be asking for vaccine free blood soon. Just like there was this thing in the popular media a week or two ago for unvaccinated sperm.
Mm.
So there's Facebook groups for this, because of course, if you need to be artificially inseminated, the first place you're going to go to is a Facebook group like Sperm or Us, right? And literally there's a guy, he started this Facebook group, and I forget how many donations he's made, and he's called the Sperminator. That's his, like,
for real?
His handle on, yeah.
I need to put that on.
Yeah. And then he started this whole thing about how he's
the Sperminator.
The, you know, COVID vaccine free semen for, you know, artificial insemination. And you're just like, okay, yeah, but Facebook, really? I mean, there's people, we interviewed a former NICU physician. She is just a wonderful, wonderful lady. And she was into, you know, how do we help working mothers continue to breastfeed babies, or at least get them, you know, human milk. And there's, you know, there's breast milk banks and all this kind of stuff. And she's like, you know, we really need to be careful with this, because this whole thing is exploded on Facebook. Like, there's all these women that just trade milk.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So on Facebook. And I'm like, you know how many creepy bastards are in there? Like,
yeah, you're creating a bizarre market.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't know if somebody had tuberculosis, or if they were a drug addict, or they had hepatitis.
Yeah.
Oh, a drug addict will sell anything. They don't give a shit who it's going to affect. Yeah. All right, here's a question for you. A few of my friends have been shot, and they all tell the same story. The second they get into the emergency room, they get a catheter. Like, I had a friend who got shot in the arm, and he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I mean, he was with it. He was like, fine. The bullet went in and out of his forehead. He's like, whoa, whoa, it's my arm. And he goes to the nurse, like, we gotta give you a catheter. Why?
I think in that scenario, I think that's I'm just guessing, because I didn't practice that kind of medicine. I think that's protocol gone wild, mm-hmm. sort of like the old Girls Gone Wild videos, but it's protocols gone wild. And it's like, and they just say, you know, if you have a GSW, if you have a mass trauma event, if you call the, you know, a casualty event, whatever it is, then these are the things that we do. Yeah. And the reason is they're getting them ready to take to the OR.
Right.
But again, obviously stuff that's driven by protocol, often common sense is the first thing to die. So yes, the guy's fully awake. He's not necessarily going to the operating room. He needs it cleaned out. He needs x-rays, blah, blah, blah. He probably doesn't need a whole hell of a lot else, but most GSWs go to the operating room. So it's just like,
yeah, exactly.
Oh, he was pissed off. What happened was he was giving a guy a ticket and a guy ran up behind him and pulled his gun out of his holster and stuck his arm out to try to fight with the guy, and the guy blew a hole through his arm. I mean, he's fine, but he said the first thing he does when he gets into the emergency room, you know, they're cutting his pants off, and they're, you know, they're putting in a catheter. He's like, "What the fuck?" You know, like, you know, I got shot.
I didn't get shot there. Yep, that's worse than the gunshot wound.
Oh, definitely. I wouldn't like that. And I mean, I just had the dreaded colonoscopy, and I did it awake. Because I'm terrified of anesthesia. Do you guys, is there a downsized anesthesia or is it linked to Alzheimer's?
Not that I've heard. Not the modern stuff. Like the milk of amnesia, the white stuff, propofol, which is, you know, that is just amazing.
Instant asleep, instant awake.
Instant asleep, instant awake. You sleep, like you just think you're just like happily sleeping and then you wake up and you're in an operating theater and they're like, everything was fine.
Or in the recovery room, you're like, did I even have the thing done? That was
they're
weird.
Like, you have no polyps, and the really good news is we found your remote.
There you go.
So I kind of like it. I'm a weirdo. I kind of like that stuff. I've had, you know, Mae's had more orthopedic surgeries than I have. I've had what, 3 or 4. And so I've made friends with the anesthesiologist, and I'm like, hey, if you're gonna give me fentanyl as a pre-med anyways, why don't we do it right now? Why don't we get a few more minutes of happiness?
I went for my colonoscopy, and you know, it's first thing in the morning, and I see that the anesthesiologist guy, and he's creeping around. I says, nope, get the fuck get out of here. And what's funny is this is the second one I've gotten. It's always the same. There's always more people in there because everyone wants to see the guy that's awake and how he's going to react to it.
Yeah,
the first one I had wasn't as painful. The second one I had, I was in pain and I'm laying on my side and I'm like kind of groaning and the nurse is petting my head like a dog. And I'm saying to myself, this is what my life has become. And it's funny. So they wheel me out and I just want to leave. And they said, no, we got to wait, check your vital signs for a little while. And so they put me in a little recovery room and I'm talking to the nurse and I'm telling her I'm a retired NYPD detective. And I hear from 2 cubicles over through the little, you know, shitty shower partition, I hear, what's your tax number? I said, what? And I hear, what's your tax number? This faint voice. And the tax number is it's a number you get in the New York City Police Department. Only a cop would know what that is. And I go, were you on the job? Yeah. And you could tell he's out of it. And I go, where'd you work? And he goes, the 83 and the 75. He's telling me the precincts, right? So after I'm done, I tell the nurse, I go, can I go see this guy? She goes, yeah, fine. So I walk in there and he's coming out of the date rape drug or whatever the hell they give. What's it called?
Propofol.
Propofol. He's coming out of his propofol high and we're shooting this shit. And just as we're relieved, I said, all right, man, take care. And I go, and this never happened. And I walk out and the nurse goes, oh, you're so bad. She goes, I'm going to tell him that you really spoke to him. He's going to think he's crazy.
You're so mean.
No, that is it. Yeah. Date rape drug. Speaking of which, the last time I've had 4 or 5. I can't remember. It's been a lot. But the last time I went, the anesthesiologist, he's like, you know, hi, my name is Sam or whatever. I'm the nurse anesthetist. We're going to put you to sleep. And, you know, they don't know who I am. I've sent the surgeon or the GI guy a gazillion patients. He knows who I am. That's all happy. But, the crew doesn't know. And I said, look, that better be good shit because I have a 2-drink minimum for butt stuff. And then they're like, this is going to be awesome. Like, he's not upset. He's not worried. Actually, 3 drinks.
Tell me, you know, you guys got a book coming out. Where can people get a hold of you? Tell me about your newsletter and your podcast.
Yeah, I got a book in my head, like I told you before, that needs to come out.
It needs to come out.
Motivated by you and a couple others, Vic. But so working on that. But right now we have our lovely podcast, BS Free MD. We have multiple shows a week. So Thursdays, and of course, the podcast you can find everywhere, Apple, Spotify, all over the place. Thursdays is our regular guest interview show, and we have all kinds of a wide variety of guests, which we can get into. We do a live stream on Wednesdays called Docktails with Cocktails, where we are live. It's about an hour. It is at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, and we just do it from our home studio, share a couple drinks, a spirit of the week. We tell some funny stories. We talk about some funny strange and wacky medical tales of things we've done or seen or in the news. And we interact with the audience. So that's as best as we can. And then we repurpose that show. So it comes out on Mondays on the podcast stream. We have a little short episode called Truth Bombs that comes out Wednesday as well, where it's kind of more philosophical and we just get to talk about something. And we have a newsletter. It's called Truth Serum. It comes out weekly. It's free to sign up and get. We share some just insights and things going on in our lives with some photos and a little bit more than is on our podcast. And people can sign up for the Truth Serum email newsletter by just going onto our website. It's bsfreemd.com. You have to scroll way to the bottom to sign up. But we're on social media everywhere. We're our live stream, first of all, is on Facebook, Rumble, and X.
So it's not on YouTube anymore because I get a couple drinks of me and start ranting about stuff that rhymes with Maxine, and then they pull it
down. So those three places, otherwise you can watch the replays, but the social media sign up stuff is on Facebook, and Instagram is a good site as well to find us. We have all of our links on Instagram in our bio to find where we're at. But check out our website as well. It's getting revamped. We're getting a new website being done, so that'll be easier to navigate.
And we have got our first merch.
Yes.
So we have BS Free MD Yeti coffee whatever they are, 8 ounce. I don't even know what they call them. Like it's the travel mug, I guess.
Yeah. So far we had a contest as we moved across the country and handed them out as prizes. So we will hope to be selling merch on our new website. That and some other fun apparel, etc. So stay tuned for that.
Well, my listeners out there, it's rare where you get two doctors offering BS free medical advice. And I want to thank Tim and May so much for being on my show, and be sure to check out their website, their podcast, BS Free MD, as well as their newsletter, the Truth Serum. I also want to thank everyone for tuning in, especially my listeners in Paramus, New Jersey, Avon, Colorado, St. Augustine, Florida. And I'm going to butcher this, but Kailua, Hawaii. If you work in law enforcement or you're an interesting criminal and you'd like to be a guest on my show, feel free to drop me a note on Twitter and Instagram at VicFerrari50. If you enjoy the content, again, check out my Amazon author page. Type in my name, Vic Ferrari Like the Car, where you can preview all my books for free, including NYPD Law and Disorder. And check out my new book, NYPD Laughing in the Line of Duty. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you guys next week.